When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hope everybody's doing well today. I want to welcome everybody to the Unimpressed Podcast today. And today we have a guy named John Stamp on the Unimpressed Podcast, former FBI guy, NCIS. What else?
I started as a police officer here in Charleston. Yeah. Left there in 2004, and I did spent time with the FBI, then spent time with the NCIS. But yeah, and then I moved on to be an instructor and a teacher. Now I write books.
Well, I'm unimpressed. John's written seven books.
Seven
books. So I'm unimpressed. I haven't read one of these books yet, but I think he's got a couple to give us today. And what has been your most successful book this far?
I think you know, it's a process. You take a shot at doing one, see if you can pull it off. And as the ideas keep coming, you keep going, but you grow as you do it. So I feel like probably my newest one is probably my most evolved work.
Okay.
Each one has little things, characters that I really enjoyed coming up with and making, you know, executing. But when it comes to putting it all together, I think Blood Red Ivory is probably the most evolved of my works.
And what is your inspiration?
The Blood Red Ivory alone was one that had a little more development to it, kind of a longer development than some of the others. I had an idea for a character. Over the last 20 years, I've worked with just amazing police officers and agents and analysts, and I've always had an idea for my character to kind of be an amalgam of them. But mostly, my favorite people have always been the funniest and the most sarcastic, coming to the squad or be a part of the agency.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to make Ty, my character's name's Ty Benhoff, make him just a, you know, a tenacious investigator, but at the same time has a real hard time taking things serious. So I had him floating around in my head for a while, and I couldn't figure out the best way to deploy him. And then I read an article about this group of women out of Zimbabwe, all female wildlife rangers fighting poachers in rural Africa. And they all had a background of, you know, abuse, domestic abuse, sexual assault. This is a true story. Mm-hmm. An Australian SAS guy, I think, if I'm getting this right, comes in, decides he wants to get into the wildlife protection world, and he creates a unit based just solely of these women and deploy them, train them up as he was trained, deploy them out into the field, and they've had an amazing effect.
Mm-hmm.
The moment I read that, I need to take this story and I need to make this part of a book. So
yeah.
I took Ty, who'd been sitting on the shelf for a while, put him in the NCIS because the Naval Criminal Investigative Service is deployable worldwide.
Yeah.
There's an office pretty much everywhere. So I was like, oh, I can do a lot with that guy. So I'm like, all right, here's a murder in rural Zimbabwe. Drop him in the middle of it, trying to solve a homicide while he's walking right into the middle of a wildlife trafficking, you know, war between two factions, a group of ivory poachers and these female rangers. And he's got to try to figure out the homicide, but he's also just walks right into the meat grinder and has to figure out how to survive it at the same time. So
have you ever took your material and pitched it to any networks or anything like that?
No, I actually, you know, writing's a business.
Yeah.
But I could be a little slow on the uptake sometimes. So I've had a really good time the last decade writing.
Yeah.
Never really considered, other than putting a good story out, you know, and my wife and I, it's funny, my wife and I were at a book conference last year, and she's talking to all these different authors, very successful authors.
Mm-hmm.
And she's, you know, what do you do? What do you do? What do you do? And they're all telling her how they run their business and how they market and how they do all this stuff. And she just looks at me, she goes, you need to get over this starving artist thing and start taking it serious. I was like, all right. So I'm kind of relatively new to trying to expand anything other than writing. I'm telling Netflix right now, I'm available. If they want to talk, I'm available. I'll talk to Amazon too. No problem.
What's been your biggest book before this one?
Probably my third book, Spoilers. It's probably a toss up between Brother's Keeper and Spoilers. Both of them evolved a different way, but both are crime thrillers set in Charleston.
Mm-hmm.
And Spoilers, the characters just took over my plot line and just went completely sideways with it. I had a plan of, you know, following a narcotics unit, working in the city. They kick in a certain door and find contraband, a specified, you know, really tricked out weapon that's not supposed to exist. They stumble into an arms trafficking operation running through the Lowcountry. Very connected, of course. Very connected intelligence field and intelligence agencies driven, stuff like that. They actually become the hunted as they, you know, face the pressure from the local politicians to, you know, their own administration, decide to go forward with an investigation that ends up making them the target of this international organization. So I was pretty rough on Charleston in that one. We destroyed a lot of property in that book. But the thing with the characters is I had my guy, Lieutenant Peter Banks. He was the protagonist. He was the leader of this unit, an older lieutenant with a group of young detectives, you know, ready to go at any minute. And about a quarter of the way through, the female detective on the team, Poppy, takes over. She's funnier. She's wittier. She's smarter than the other guy she's working with. I have a female assassin also that's called in by this agency to start taking out these people. And she is a psycho. Like, I didn't write her as a psycho. I wrote her as kind of like a cold Michael Myers, you know, in the outline. And she turns into like the Joker. As I'm writing, as I'm doing my first draft, she gets this very cynical Joker-esque feel to her. And I was like, so the females completely took over this book and really, I think, made it flourish just in the way that what they added. Their characters as they evolved were just their scenes were better. They were, you know, their lines were better. As I'm writing this, I'm getting to, you know, the main battle between the good guys and the bad guys. And I have everybody. It's basically a shootout on John's Island, Main and Maybank. That big intersection there.
Okay.
And so I'm moving these people around the chessboard. It's like basically like the gunfight in Heat. One of my good guys about to get zipped by a bad guy, and I've got nobody left. Like, all my pieces are gone. Like, I've lost all my chessboard pieces. I'm like, well, I got plans for that guy. He can't go. Mm-hmm. So I had to go back through the story, wrote in another character for about 15,000 words. Also, she could come in and run over the bad guy with a car. That's what I needed her for. But I ended up drawing her as a rookie police officer, rookie female in a male-dominated career field.
Yeah.
Got to show her as trying to get the respect she deserves and trying to show her that her internal struggle with some of the problems of being a part of that career field sometimes. So she flourished into an amazing character arc. And the whole reason I needed her was to basically take out a guy because I had nobody else to spare my other good guy here.
Yeah.
So it was another piece of the chessboard that I had to sprinkle in. So as those characters came about, I think they really resonated with people. So I think that's why spoilers kind of became what it is. And it's just a very well character driven story. But those characters on the page, they weren't what I originally sketched them as. But as the prose and the narrative grew, I was like, man, I love these women. These guys are great. You know.
So you grew up between Rochester and Syracuse. Right.
Yep.
How long did you live in that area? You grew up there?
I grew up there, and I moved down to Charleston my sophomore year of college.
Sophomore year of college.
Yeah,
okay.
I had a buddy who would come down to the Citadel. You know, I'm sitting up here freezing my butt off. There's 3 feet of snow on the ground.
It's freezing.
Yeah. He's like, well, come on down. So I look into the Citadel, and he's like, you got to come join me next year. And I look, and I'm like seeing people marching in wool uniforms in August. I'm like, it's 100 degrees, dude. You're walking around in a wool suit. That's not me.
Yeah.
So I found another college, Charleston Southern University, that had a program that I could slide my credits into and graduated from there.
Well, and believe it or not, that's where I went to school.
Yeah.
I went to Charleston Southern.
Go Buccaneers, right?
Buccaneers, yeah.
that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I graduated there in 99.
Okay.
And during that time, I joined the police department as a reserve officer, fell in love with, once I graduated, moved on and got on with the city of Charleston and stayed there until I moved on to the FBI in late 2004.
So did you, in 2004, when you went to the FBI, you're a cop here locally. Now, was your FBI agent here in Charleston as well?
No. But at the time, you get picked up with the FBI and you have to go someplace else. You just couldn't stay in place, especially a rookie agent isn't getting to go to a place like Charleston. You know, so what they do is they give you the ranking field offices, and me and my wife sit down and we rank where we want to go. Once you pass firearms tests, you know, at week 7 and week 8, you have what's called orders night. So the entire class comes together. You get your envelope and you have to walk up in front of class and call your shot. You know, where do you think you're going? What'd you rank? Where are you going? I called my shot. We ranked Buffalo field office number 1.
Yeah.
Because at least we could go someplace where family was relatively close by. And so I go up on orders night and the coordinator's like, where are you going? I was like, I'm going to Buffalo. Is that your first pick? I was like, yep. He's like, you really think you're going to get your first pick? I was like, do you know anybody here that wants to go to Buffalo? And he's No. So we moved back up to New York, and I worked in Buffalo for three years and change.
After the FBI, what?
Well, after the FBI, my wife and I wanted to travel. Out of the blue, NCIS calls, because my application apparently was still active.
Okay.
And so one night, I'm driving home, we're staring on the barrel of going to one of these giant cities, and it's blizzarding out, it's miserable. And the NCIS lady on the other side of the phone, she goes, well, if you're still interested, what do you think of Pensacola, Florida? Same gig, same retirement.
Yeah.
But, that had that international travel opportunity, Europe, Singapore, wherever the Navy is, they're going to have NCIS agents there. So let's do this. Let's just jump on that train and go travel. 7 years I was with them. I got to go to 9 countries.
What's the angle in the situation where you have to go somewhere? What are you trying to solve or do?
Purview is anything Navy related, felony level investigations, and counterintelligence. I could work a fraud on a Monday, a burglary on a Tuesday, a death on a Wednesday, an assault on a Thursday. It fit my personality because I consider myself to have a little bit of ADHD when it comes to career. So it's always, if I see a cool looking squirrel that I want to chase, I just go do it.
So NCIS, 7 years, then what after that?
Well, after that 7 years, the kids started coming. We go up to Syracuse for a little while. We have our first child. Time comes, 3 to 5 years, where we go hit Hawaii or Japan or some other place. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, we're changing diapers at like 2 months in, and we just look at each other and like, the idea of, not having this kid raised in the same place just changed everything. It just kind of changed our outlook. So
yeah.
I had to find something permanent. So I became an instructor down at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center down in Georgia.
What's your day look like when you show up at the training facility? It's a federal training facility. Federal training facility for FBI agents?
No, it's 118 different agencies. Wherever you're assigned, you could be teaching a kid how to pull over a car. You could be on a bomb range. Yeah, you could be teaching crime scenes, and that was my background is a crime scene. I was a member of the ERT when I was with the FBI, a member of the crime scene team at the NCIS, and my master's in forensics. So I got to teach.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Teach crime scene instruction to agents coming through.
And how old are these guys coming through?
They can be anywhere from 20 to like 50. You have a long program going on. Everybody's feeling themselves out for 3 or 4 days, and then just trash talk. Just the interagency trash talk starts, and it's one of my favorite jobs I've ever had, actually.
I mentioned earlier, they ever film anything? Any of you film that? It seemed like that would be some good content. Would they let you film it, first of all?
It depends. I've seen CBP has done a documentary following trainees through there. I call it an adult playground because you can go get beat up in a red man suit at one point, or you could chase cars in another part of the facility.
And what town is this in?
We're down at, we've got one in Charleston here, Brunswick, Georgia, an hour south of Savannah.
They just had this project in Charleston where it's supposed to be the deepest port on the East Coast. Is there anything that we'd be surprised about that's going on here, right here by the water?
Not that I would. I'd be aware of. I left here in 2004. I come back as a tourist now, and I love the city.
Would there be something we would be surprised to hear about?
Best thing about a criminal is that they're just opportunists. So if Charleston's got that gateway, and it's always has been. So that's why I think I've put a lot of my settings here, history and the vibe of the city. It's just a great place to write a story. That's why my first 5 books are set here.
You got third generation families here.
That does run a strain through my book.
This is the best place in the world for backdrops and culture and just a little bit of everything.
took a off-duty gig one day to sit on Church Street when it was converted into Revolutionary pre-Civil War times for the movie Cold Mountain.
Okay.
And I remembered, you know, walking out on the set and it was just, you know, they just completely transformed it. And you speak of the history and all the backdrops and stuff, random little nuggets that you probably don't get anyplace else but Charleston, Secessionville out on James Island. I get a call out there one day for an alarm. So it's a burglary alarm.
Mm-hmm.
So I walk out there and I'm walking around the house and waiting, you know, making sure that nothing's broken into, making sure there's no open doors, broken windows, stuff like that. And as I'm walking around the back of the house, everything's cool. And I'd see this big plastic bin filled with water and there's 2-foot-long mortar shells in there. That's interesting. I was like, and so the guy who owns the house shows up and tell, you know, we're going through the whole thing. Everything's cool. Reset the alarm. I go, what are those? He goes, oh yeah, those are mortars, probably Civil War-ish. And he kicks the bucket while I'm standing there. And I'm like, no, like that's unexploded ordnance. That's a couple hundred years old. This guy would just go out in the marsh and dig this stuff up, take it back. And there's still stories where those things kick off every now and then, you know. That
oh, really?
Rattle.
So he was actually digging them up right out by his house.
You know, you live in the middle of what once was a fort or a battlefield. You've got that opportunity, and a place like Charleston just facilitates that.
Yeah.
So much history here that...
And digging into your head a little bit, you know, obviously a very dynamic personality, being in law enforcement. And now when you are at work, are you like the most cut and dry person? And then you have like that alter ego that is your escapism to put it on pen and paper?
You know, there's times where you got to be on the ball, you know, and there's times where you got to, you know, make a switch and be pretty serious about things. But as an investigator, come in all hardcore and everybody you talk to, you don't get a whole lot. It's the best police officers I ever worked with and agents were the ones that could have a conversation with a wall. Naturally, that hasn't always been me.
Mm-hmm.
So it took a long time for me to try and become that communicator. So I always tried to you know, dress down, dress casually, try to be friendly to everybody I meet, because that's how people start to talk to you and trust you. And trust and communication is a giant part of, you know, the criminal justice world. So I always tried to keep it relatively even keeled. I don't know if I've always pulled it off, but I try.
This character you have in this recent book is somewhat lackadaisical, relaxed, or just is that you?
No, he's a little different than me. He's a bit more rebellious than I think I would consider myself. He's a bit more sarcastic on some things. Doesn't, you know, tries not to take stuff too seriously, but also when the time comes, you know, crime scene or you're processing a body, it's a homicide case he's working. So it's time to be detail oriented and conscious of what you're doing. You know, when it comes to his superiors and management back at headquarters, he has very little time for time wasting, stuff like that. So he gets himself into a little bit of a bit of trouble at times with the bureaucratic side of that life. His patience is sometimes strained.
And when you were growing up in New York, did you always have a creative mindset?
I know that I almost failed math in sixth grade because I decided to write a book by hand in math class instead of actually doing math. So I wrote like 55 handwritten pages of an awful like alien abduction story when I was like 9.
Really?
So I was always trying to write. One of the first books I ever read was Jaws. And I remember doing it. I'm like, yeah, that's, I'm like, this guy just sits down here and puts out a story like that. I'm like, that's kind of what I want to do. So I would write an outline, but I could never figure out how to actually put a novel together until like I was 36 years old is when I finally was able to get it from beginning to end, from A to Z.
Obviously, you have the experience in law enforcement, whatever. Is it just rationale to put 2 and 2 together to drive that personality in a book?
No, it's basically, you know, keeping that character's mindset in your head. And I write, and it sounds weird, but I basically write the movie I see in my head, and I just hit pause when my writing session's done every day, and I pick up where I left off. But I kind of write it as I see it. And the character, you know, I'll sketch out the character as I'm building the outline. But then once I get going, I seldom revert back to my outline. I just follow the path, you know, as the character tries to get from A to Z. But they having the characters, that character's mindset in there is part of the process. When I build them, that just kind of sticks with me throughout the process of the book.
You know, and you had never really tried to pursue anything with it. You just want to write.
Well, it's, you know, at this, as I start to think about it, I'm like, I'd love to push this further and, you know, become that Tom Clancy-esque author, you know. So that's been a change of mindset. I really just did it as exercise. Yeah, like you say, it's a release. I look at it now as going to the gym. You know, you skip the gym 3 or 4 days, you start getting grouchy. I skip writing 3 or 4 days and I start getting the same kind of grouchy. So I guess it has been kind of an exercise of the mind, and it's just kind of grown into that. At this stage,
because they say creative comes from the darkest places.
It does.
You know, I have comedians and work with them, and some of the best comedians have some of the darkest, have some dark past. Is there anybody in your family, mom and dad, or anything that had a creative mindset? I mean, what was childhood like?
Childhood, I grew up in the country. There's more cows than people where I come from. And
yeah,
when you explain you grew up in New York, you always got to make sure they know that you grew up in where the pastures are in New York, not the concrete. And
Well, there's more. Yeah, I mean, being in New Jersey, I mean, once we got past Tuxedo Park, there's more rednecks, you know, there's more rednecks that way than there is in North Carolina or South Carolina, for that matter, you know.
Oh, yeah. I reported to an office in Earl, New Jersey at one point, and driving through horse country the first time, I was like, this is still New Jersey?
Yeah.
It takes a minute, but people have the same outlook of New York. And I grew up surrounded by lakes, surrounded by farms, partying in cornfields in high school. It's pretty much Mayberry. You know, it's a great place, and I love every chance I get to go back there. I grew up in the country. No hidden darkness, you know, none of that. It's actually just really entertaining because, you know, my family is traditionally truckers. You know, the stories from a long haul trucker. My grandpa on the other side was a fireman. I think I just always wanted to build those stories out, you know.
Gotcha. So do you have distribution? Who's your distribution with?
Right now I'm with Wild Blue Press.
Wild
Blue Press. They've published Blood Red Ivory. Did the audiobook for Blood Red Ivory. Found it. I got saying who the narrator was. But yeah, they're a true crime and thriller press. The other ones each originally had a publisher, and as they came off contract, I back out myself. Had my own covers, so I started figuring out the business process a little bit there. But yeah, as we move forward, I need to start building, as you say, the career side.
Well, I mean, that I think in the book business is just like anything else. It's just like obviously you got to create some value for yourself as a writer, right? Like anybody else in this business, you got to, especially entertainment, I think you got to build value in yourself. And then once you build some value, it's either getting to the right person, you know, and it's timing. You know, and then get somebody to say yes. It doesn't say that Tom, you could be better than Tom Clancy, but somebody said yes to Tom Clancy a long time ago.
Yep. Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
It can be, your book running into an agent's desk and the agents miss their cup of coffee that day and there's just no chance. You know, it could be as easy as something like that. You know, are they calling sick that day and you end up on the bottom of the slush pile? There's a lot of chance, especially in this business where it's flooded. You know, there's so many authors out there trying to make something of their work.
How do you create a buzz around your projects?
Still figuring that one out too. It has been, you know, the publisher puts it out and I'll pop it on social media, stuff like that. I've taken to studying and starting to get into the ads on social media, the ads on like Amazon, learning that marketing side of the business. I come on, you know, shows like this is every chance I get. Go to book conferences, spend a weekend with a bunch of readers doing panels, answering questions, hanging out with people, doing book signings every chance I get. It's great when you get to go out there and talk to people are just in train with those books too. There, you know, you're talking to fans, you're talking to readers, you know, getting into really in-depth conversations about some of their favorite books you've ever read, other things like that. So I'm figuring out as I go, so to speak.
We had a book deal. It kind of had the law enforcement element, and then it had like the spiritual, like supernatural element. And she's actually from my hometown, and I can't even remember who it is, but she's had a couple of New York Times bestsellers. You know, has there been a movie made like that in Charleston?
And I know that movies have been made around here, and I actually follow that back home because Savannah's got a great film scene too. Story about that, but I don't know if anybody's ever taken a production and run it right through the setting of Charleston. But like you said, it's the setting, the scenery, just the flow of the town is perfectly made for stuff like that. I always kind of look at my stuff as John Fuqua, that gritty crime thrillers that he does. I just think he's got a great eye for that sort of thing.
Has anybody critiqued your writing, how fluid it is or anything like that?
You know, the best thing you can get is an editor that really doesn't care what your feelings are. So it's always... it's always great when an editor gives you a compliment, because it's, you know, I've had him tell me, like, you know, I don't usually say this, but this passage is just great, or this dialogue energy. But yeah, I've had a couple editors that have said that, you know, spoilers made them think of Clancy. They said the writing, the way I drew Ty, Veronica, and some of the other characters in Blood Red Ivory was just kind of a fresh take on some things. Because I try not to, you know, the crime thriller can be very dark and very gritty. Add elements of, you know, when there's room, you can make it light. You know, when there's going to be dark spots, especially if I'm working a homicide case, there's a darkness there. Somebody's dead, and that case is going to take over. But in the you know, there's always a real black humor within law enforcement. So if I can find ways to kick that in there, so having my reader, you know, going through a relatively tense scene and just having a one liner out there, just contrast with that seriousness every now and then. I try to do that. And my last editor was, she liked some of what she saw with that. So, I always tell people, you know, you'd think that this is a very solitary business, because it's you and a keyboard. And if you're not pounding out the words on the page, nobody's ever going to know that you almost wrote a book, you know? Mm-hmm. And, you know, if I was to write the book, critique my first draft, do another edit and throw it out there, it'd be garbage. Cause you don't have anybody else. So you're so myopic on what your words are. You automatically think you're awesome because you just wrote this. You can't see what other people see. So you always need, I've got a group of beta readers that will let me know when I'm off. So, and most of them are guys that I've worked with. I've got a couple US Marshals, some other agents. Mm-hmm. So they'll especially when it comes to the guns stuff and the tactics stuff, though, you're way off. Like you've been out of the field too long. This doesn't work. You're writing a John Woo movie here, not keeping the tactics. So
yeah,
So
you try to stay tactical.
Well, I try to stay accurate. Because my friends read, people are in the field investigating and scenes and working cases, and I don't want to write something that they're going to be like, he's lost it, you know? Because it's like, for me, my wife's a nurse and I'm in law enforcement. So we can't watch cop shows. We can't agree on medical shows, because if I'm watching a police show and somebody walks in a crime scene without gloves on, it makes me go into a fit.
Yeah.
She's a surgical nurse. So if she's watching Grey's Anatomy and somebody breaks the sterile field without being gowned and masked up and starts grabbing tools without gloves on, she starts losing it. So
yeah,
it makes entertainment at night kind of funny.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So I always want to make sure I'm accurate, that I've got that honest voice and it's current and it sticks to accepted guidelines that we all work under.
Now, spoilers. What is spoilers? Is spoilers a movie? Is it a series? What are the books? Are they all movies? Are they a series? What is it?
They're movies in my head. Spoilers was never intended to be a series, but like I mentioned earlier, that female assassin Bianca,
is
so psycho that I wanted her back. Like I wasn't done with that character. So spoilers, as it wrapped up, she was just like, her character was so dynamic. I was like, nah, I brought her back in and mixed her up with intelligence world that decides it's time to mop up what's left. So some of my characters, Banks and his people, survive, spoilers, kind of win the day. But that's hanging over the head of these people that are involved in some very lucrative and illegal business. So that rather than leaving loose ends, they decide to come back at him.
Yeah.
But they also decide that Bianca's got to go too, because she knows what the operation is. So when they try to take out her, it goes incredibly bad, and it just kind of builds from there as my guys who were, you know, the investigators and spoilers are now being hunted, but they don't know it. They've moved on to different roles. They're not all working together anymore. So they've got to A, figure out that they're being targeted, and B, survive long enough to be able to counter it. Spoilers, it's called Where Angels Sing is the second book, and it just follows them having to survive the mop-up efforts of this organization.
Oh, in your head, they're a movie.
Oh yeah, they're written like a movie. It's Michael Crichton's always been one of my favorite authors.
Yeah.
And as you read a Michael Crichton book, he writes like it's a movie. Every Michael Crichton book I've ever, Jurassic Park to Sphere to the Congo, as you read those, you can see that movie in your head. And it's just the way he organizes it, the way he writes it by scene by scene. I always thought, you know, Congo, which the book's amazing. And when Congo came out, it's how you saw it go. Just the way he wrote that book was written to be on a screen.
Could you write a screenplay, or would you want somebody to write a screenplay of your book?
You know, the book is 85 to 100,000 words, and then the screenplay has to be caught at 120 pages.
A minute a page.
Yeah, so it's one of those things where, and the formatting is, you know, here's character and here's his line, and three sentences to explain what the scene looks like. And I've tried, and I'm going through my book, and I'm like, oh, I gotta cut that. Ooh, you know, it hurts.
Yeah.
But I've actually read different screenplays of movies that I really liked, and then tried to adapt my stuff. And it's one of those things I think I could do it, but it's a matter of time. That's hard, you know, with the kids and the job and stuff. But no, if somebody wanted to make a go of it, I would be well into it. But I also got a call to do the new Halloween movie, which was cool. But really, I just wanted to do that. So the production that goes into getting that 5-minute scene is fascinating to watch the mechanics of.
I got to let my wife critique the book. And I don't know. I know some people.
Using this city to tell a really good crime thriller, I think the city is perfectly made for it.
Out of the 7 books, what would be the book you'd want to put out there first?
My first book was actually a horror novel, and I put him up against, because I wanted to take that stereotype of the police procedural and throw it up against demons.
Gotcha.
Yeah, just take those two worlds and smash them together. It was my first book. I was like, yeah, I'm going to see how it goes here. I love the aspect of that, because I cover everything from John's Island, some of the old plantation houses on John's Island, to South Abroad, to the market. Got a couple really cool scenes on market. But Charleston does have that kind of spiritual element. You know, there's a ghost story. There's a ghost story at every building around town. You know, so it's kind of fun to play with that side of things. Outside of that, I think Spoilers was really well created. It stretches from scenes in the upstate to the port. Got a couple of really good, really fun chases up and down some of the places.
So what was the name of the horror movie?
Shattered Circle.
Shattered Circle.
Was my first book.
First book.
Yep.
Spoilers.
Spoilers.
And then the last book was?
Last book's Blood Red Ivory.
Blood Red Ivory.
Yeah, and between those, that's the one that takes place in Africa.
Appreciate you coming in, and anything else we want to cover? I mean, I think we talked about some good stuff today.
I appreciate you having me on. I did kick off a podcast. I had so much fun doing media for Blood Red Ivory. I started in April. My publisher has a deep list of really good true crime authors and thriller writers that I've just gotten to, you know, have a great conversation with somebody every week, learning from different authors and different experts. I've had a blast doing it. So it's called That's Criminal.
That's Criminal podcast with John Stamp.
Yep. Yeah, it's pretty much available everywhere. Other than that, you can find me on primarily like Instagram, Facebook, at John Stamp Writer. I've been enjoying your videos.
So. Oh, thank you.
Yeah,
I appreciate
that's
that.
That's been a lot of fun. Yeah.
Cool, so cool. I appreciate that.
I enjoy seeing those.
John, I appreciate you coming in. This is author John Stamp.
Stamp, yep.
Yep.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, he's got some great material out there, so check him out. Appreciate everybody listening to the show, and I'm John Edmonds Cosma, the CEO of Bang Productions.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.